A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's personal. He's describing a journey a lot of people will recognize. Spent years self-medicating with caffeine, functioning until life got harder. Finally saw a psychiatrist after gallbladder surgery, forced the issue. And he got what he calls a red pill, blue pill moment, SSRI, or Ritalin. He chose Ritalin first, eventually ended up on both, and has been stable on that combination for years. But here's the thing he's wrestling with. He feels like the ADHD is baked into who he is, while the depression isn't his core self. And that leads to three concrete questions. 1. Can people with secondary depression ever stabilize enough to get off the antidepressant? 2. Does that actually happen under clinical supervision? And 3. Is it more common for people with this comorbidity to just stay on both long-term?
This is one of those questions where the way it's asked already tells you the person has done serious thinking about their own mind. The distinction between what feels baked in and what feels imposed. That's not just poetry. That maps onto something real in the clinical picture. So let's start with the numbers, because they're striking. About 30 to 40% of people with ADHD also meet criteria for major depressive disorder at some point, and the arrow of causation isn't symmetrical. When you look at longitudinal studies, ADHD in childhood predicts later depression far more strongly than the reverse, which means for a large subset of people, the depression really is secondary. It's downstream of living with untreated ADHD.
The depression isn't a separate thing that happened to land on them. It's more like the exhaust from an engine that's been running wrong for decades.
That's exactly the metaphor, and it matters enormously for treatment sequencing. There's a paper from the Canadian ADHD Resource Alliance, CADDRA, that lays out a treatment hierarchy. If you suspect the depression is secondary to ADHD, the recommendation is to treat the ADHD first. Because if you start with an SSRI and the core problem is executive dysfunction, you might just get a less sad person who still can't initiate tasks, still can't organize their life, and is now maybe a little emotionally blunted while they're at it.
Which is basically the pharmacological equivalent of putting a fresh coat of paint on a house with a cracked foundation.
And here's where the prompt's experience maps onto good clinical practice. Choosing Ritalin first, in that framing, was probably the correct instinct. Not because SSRIs are bad, but because the diagnostic logic says, let's see what remains after we address the ADHD. If the mood symptoms lift when executive function improves, you might be looking at secondary depression. If they don't, you're dealing with a true comorbidity that needs its own direct treatment.
In his case, he ended up needing both, which is its own data point.
But let's get to the first question. Can someone with secondary depression stabilize enough to come off the antidepressant? The short answer is yes, it happens. The longer answer is that it depends on whether the depression was truly secondary or whether it was a co-occurring condition that the ADHD was just making worse. Those are different things, and teasing them apart takes time.
How do you actually tease them apart clinically? Because from the patient's chair, you're just feeling what you're feeling.
One approach is what's called a sequential treatment design. You optimize the ADHD medication first, get the dose right, get the formulation right, give it several months, then you reassess the depression. If the Beck depression inventory score has dropped significantly just from stimulant treatment, that's evidence the depression was at least partly secondary. At that point, some clinicians will try a cautious taper of the antidepressant, especially if the patient is motivated to see if they can manage without it.
Cautious taper? What does that actually look like in practice?
It's slower than most people think. For an SSRI, you're typically reducing the dose by about 10% every 2 to 4 weeks, sometimes even slower if the person has been on it for years. You do it during a period of relative life stability, not during a move, not during a job change. And you're monitoring not just for depressive symptoms, but for what's called discontinuation syndrome, which can mimic depression and confuse the picture.
Discontinuation syndrome being the brain zaps, the irritability, the flu-like symptoms.
And this is where a lot of people get tripped up. They taper too fast, feel terrible, conclude they need the medication, and go back on, when what they actually experienced was withdrawal, not relapse. A properly slow taper can take months, and it requires patience that, irony alert, someone with ADHD may find especially challenging.
The condition making the treatment harder. Of course it does.
There's a paper from Horowitz and Taylor in The Lancet Psychiatry that made waves a few years ago. They argued that standard tapering protocols are way too aggressive, and that hyperbolic dose reduction, where you cut by smaller and smaller amounts as you approach zero, produces much better outcomes. Their point was that the relationship between SSRI dose and serotonin transporter occupancy isn't linear. You can go from 20 milligrams to 10 without much trouble, but going from 5 to 0 is a cliff for some people.
The last mile is the hardest, which means someone could be fine for most of the taper and then hit a wall right at the end.
That wall gets misinterpreted as, I guess I'm just a person who needs this medication forever, when it might actually be that the taper was too fast at the tail. That's a crucial distinction for the question about whether this happens under clinical supervision, because it does, but the quality of that supervision varies enormously. A good clinician knows about hyperbolic tapering. A less informed one might say, just cut the pill in half for 2 weeks and stop, and then when the patient crashes, they both conclude the medication is necessary long term.
Which brings us to the second question. Does this actually happen in real clinical practice, the successful discontinuation?
I've seen it. In pediatric practice, which was my world, you'd sometimes see teenagers who'd been put on an SSRI during a crisis period. Parents divorcing, school collapse, social disaster, and the ADHD was the underlying constant. Once the stimulant was optimized and the life situation stabilized, they could taper off the SSRI and do fine. The key variable wasn't the severity of the original depression. It was whether the environment had changed enough that the ADHD was no longer generating constant failure experiences.
You're saying the depression is almost a rational response to the situation the ADHD creates. Fix the situation, and the depression loses its fuel source.
That's the secondary depression model in a nutshell, and it's why the prompt's instinct about depression not being true to his core self is clinically meaningful. Patients are often right about this. When someone says, this isn't me, clinicians should listen. There's a concept called ego dystonic versus ego syntonic. An ego dystonic symptom feels alien, like an intruder. Ego syntonic feels like just who you are. And people with secondary depression often describe their low mood as ego dystonic, while their ADHD traits feel ego syntonic.
Which maps exactly onto what he wrote. Depression isn't his core self. ADHD is baked in.
That self-assessment has diagnostic weight. It's not dispositive, you can't hang a treatment decision on it alone, but it's a signal. The flip side is that some people have primary depression that predates their ADHD, or that runs in their family independently, and for them, the depression may feel just as baked in as the ADHD. Those are the cases where discontinuation is less likely to succeed.
Let's talk about the third question, the long-term both medication scenario. How common is that?
More common than the pure discontinuation scenario, honestly. When you look at long-term follow-up studies of adults with ADHD and comorbid depression, the majority who respond to combination treatment stay on combination treatment. Not because they're stuck on it, but because both conditions are chronic and the combination works. There's a large registry study out of Sweden that tracked adults with ADHD over 5 years. About 60% of those with comorbid depression remained on both an ADHD medication and an antidepressant throughout the study period.
So we're talking about the majority path, not the exception.
And that number might actually undercount, because the Swedish registry only captures filled prescriptions. Some people might have been prescribed both, but only filling one. The point is, staying on both is not a treatment failure. It's not a sign that something went wrong. It's the expected outcome for a substantial portion of people with this comorbidity profile.
That's worth sitting with for a second, because I think there's a cultural narrative, maybe unspoken, that the goal of psychiatric treatment is to eventually get off everything. That medication is a bridge, not a destination.
That narrative is powerful and, I think, often counterproductive. It treats psychiatric conditions as acute problems that should resolve, rather than chronic conditions that may need ongoing management. Nobody tells someone with type 1 diabetes that the goal is to eventually get off insulin. But with psychiatric medication, There's this ambient pressure, sometimes from family, sometimes internalized, that being on something long-term means you haven't really fixed the problem.
The just needing a crutch framing.
Which is absurd if you think about it for 5 seconds. A crutch is a tool that lets you walk when you otherwise couldn't. What's shameful about that? But the metaphor gets used as a dismissal. In reality, for someone with both ADHD and recurrent depression, the combination of stimulant and antidepressant might be more like glasses than a crutch. It corrects a deficit, and you wear them every day, and nobody thinks you failed at seeing because you still need the glasses.
Although I'd add, and I think the prompt is getting at this, there's a difference between accepting long-term treatment and wanting to know if it's truly necessary. Those aren't contradictory. You can be at peace with taking two medications and still be curious about whether one of them is pulling its weight.
That's a completely reasonable thing to want to know. And the way to find out is a properly conducted taper under good supervision during a stable life period with the understanding that if depressive symptoms return, you have your answer and you go back on. That's not failure. That's a diagnostic experiment.
Let's talk about what under the guidance of a clinician actually means in this context. Because I think there's a gap between what people imagine and what often happens. Someone goes to their doctor and says, I'd like to try coming off my antidepressant. And the doctor says, okay, cut the dose in half for 2 weeks and stop. And that's the guidance.
That's the guidance, and it's often inadequate. A proper guided taper involves scheduled check-ins, every 2 weeks at minimum during the active reduction phase. It involves symptom tracking, ideally with a validated scale like the PHQ-9 or the MARS, so you're not relying on subjective, I feel worse, which could be withdrawal or could be relapse. It involves planning the taper for a period when the patient isn't facing major stressors. And it involves a clear agreement about what constitutes a reason to pause or reverse the taper.
That level of attention, is that accessible to most people?
It depends enormously on the healthcare system. In a well-resourced psychiatry practice, yes. In a 15-minute primary care visit, no. And that's a real structural problem, because a lot of antidepressant prescribing happens in primary care. The physician who started the medication may not feel equipped to manage a complex taper, and the specialist who could manage it may have a 6-month waiting list.
The practical barrier isn't, is this medically possible? It's, can I access the supervision needed to do it safely?
That's a huge part of it. And it connects to something else. The stimulant side of the equation matters for the taper's success. If someone's ADHD is well managed on medication, their executive function is better, their emotional regulation is better, their life is more stable. All of that creates the conditions where an antidepressant taper is more likely to succeed. If the ADHD is undertreated, the taper is happening on shakier ground.
Optimizing the stimulant first isn't just about diagnostic clarity. It's about building a platform from which you can safely experiment with reducing the other medication.
Treat the ADHD aggressively, get that stable, then ask the depression question. That's the sequence. And if you do it in that order, some people discover that their depression was largely the emotional dysregulation and demoralization that comes from untreated ADHD. The rejection sensitivity, the shame spirals, the chronic underperformance, those can look a lot like depression, and they often respond to stimulant treatment.
Rejection sensitivity, that's the part of ADHD that doesn't get talked about enough. The emotional piece.
Rejection sensitive dysphoria. It's not in the DSM, but it's widely recognized clinically. It's that intense emotional pain in response to perceived rejection or criticism. People with RSD describe it as a physical blow. And it's often misdiagnosed as depression, because the patient comes in saying, I feel terrible about myself, I can't handle criticism, I'm emotionally all over the place. That sounds like depression. But SSRIs often don't touch RSD, whereas stimulants and some alpha-2 agonists like guanfacine can be remarkably effective.
Part of the diagnostic puzzle is this depression or is this RSD or is it both?
The only way to know is to treat sequentially and observe. If the depression lifts with stimulant monotherapy, it might have been RSD or secondary depression. If it doesn't, you're looking at a genuine comorbidity.
Which is exactly where the prompt's journey led. Tried the stimulant, still needed the antidepressant. That's the data.
That data is valuable. It means the depression wasn't purely secondary. There's an independent mood component that needs its own treatment. And once you know that, the question becomes, Is this a chronic condition I manage or an acute condition I've recovered from? And the answer, for most people with recurrent depression, leans chronic.
Let's dig into the recurrence piece, because I think that's the crux of the long-term question. If someone has had one major depressive episode, what are the odds of another?
After one episode, the lifetime recurrence risk is about 50%. After two episodes, it's about 70%. After three, it's 90%. Those numbers are from the STAR-D trial and subsequent longitudinal work. And those recurrence rates are for depression generally. Add ADHD to the mix, and the numbers probably go higher, because ADHD is a chronic stress generator.
A chronic stress generator. That's a phrase that could describe a lot of lives.
It really could. ADHD creates friction everywhere. In relationships, in work, in basic life maintenance. That friction generates stress. Chronic stress is a risk factor for depression. So even if the depression is secondary, in the causal sense, it's being continually regenerated by the ADHD. You treat the depression, but the ADHD keeps creating conditions that could trigger another episode.
Staying on the antidepressant isn't just treating current depression. It's prophylaxis against the next one that the ADHD is busily laying the groundwork for.
That's the logic of maintenance treatment. And it's why, for someone with ADHD and recurrent depression, the default clinical recommendation is often to stay on both indefinitely. Not because tapering is impossible, but because the risk-benefit calculus favors staying the course.
The risks of long-term SSRI use. What are we actually talking about there? Because I think people have a vague sense of, I don't want to be on this forever, without a clear picture of what the downside actually is.
The side effect profile for long-term SSRI use is generally manageable for most people. Sexual side effects are the most common: decreased libido, delayed ejaculation, anorgasmia. Those affect something like 30 to 60% of patients depending on the specific medication. Weight gain is another one, especially with paroxetine and to some extent escitalopram. There's also the emotional blunting some people describe, not feeling the lows, but also not feeling the highs.
The emotional blunting is interesting in the ADHD context, because stimulants can also flatten affect for some people. You're potentially stacking two medications that each dampen emotional range.
That's a real concern, and it's something a good clinician should be monitoring. If a patient says, I feel fine, but I also feel like I'm watching my life through a window, that's a signal that something needs adjustment. It might mean the SSRI dose is too high, or it might mean switching to a different medication. Bupropion, for example, tends to have less emotional blunting and fewer sexual side effects because it works primarily on dopamine and norepinephrine rather than serotonin.
Which is also the neighborhood that stimulants play in.
Bupropion is sometimes used as a second-line ADHD treatment for that reason. It's not as effective as stimulants for attention, but it has some overlap in mechanism. And for someone with comorbid depression and ADHD, bupropion can sometimes address both with one medication. It's not the standard approach, but it's an option.
There's a whole decision tree here that the just take both and don't think about it. Advice can miss.
And the prompt's questions suggest someone who's thought carefully about that tree. Let me try to answer the three questions directly, because they deserve direct answers.
Go for it. Go for it.
Question 1. Can people with secondary depression stabilize enough to get off the antidepressant? The strongest candidates are people whose depression was clearly triggered by untreated ADHD, who have since optimized their ADHD treatment, who have stable life circumstances, and who don't have a strong independent family history of mood disorders. For those people, a slow taper under good supervision can succeed.
Question 2. Does this actually happen under clinical guidance?
Yes, it happens. But the quality of that guidance varies widely. A well-conducted taper involves hyperbolic dose reduction, scheduled monitoring, validated symptom scales, and a clear plan for what to do if symptoms return. A poorly conducted taper is cut the pills and see what happens. The difference in outcomes between those two approaches is substantial.
Question 3. Is it more common to stay on both long-term?
The majority of people with ADHD and recurrent depression who respond to combination treatment remain on both medications long-term. This is not a treatment failure. It's the expected course for two chronic conditions that are effectively managed with medication. The question isn't, can I get off this, so much as, Is this combination working well enough that the benefits outweigh the side effects and inconvenience? For many people, the answer to that question is yes.
There's something else in the prompt that I want to pull on. He describes the Ritalin as feeling less scary than the SSRI, and he says if he had to pick one, it'd be the stimulant. That hierarchy. Stimulants feel more acceptable than antidepressants. I think that's widespread, and I'm not sure it's entirely rational.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Stimulants are Schedule II controlled substances. They're more tightly regulated, harder to get prescribed, more stigmatized in some ways. But for someone with ADHD, they often feel more legitimate because the effect is immediate and obvious. You take a stimulant, and within an hour you can focus. The SSRI takes weeks to work, the effect is subtle, and you're not entirely sure it's doing anything until you look back over months and realize you haven't had a depressive episode.
The stimulant gives you a before and after you can feel. The antidepressant gives you a statistical reduction in risk you have to infer.
Human psychology strongly prefers the first kind of evidence. We trust what we can feel. Plus, there's the identity piece. I take medication to help me focus, feels like a tool. I take medication to prevent depression, feels like a vulnerability. Even though both are tools and both address vulnerabilities.
Like the difference between wearing glasses and taking blood pressure medication. Nobody feels existentially threatened by their glasses.
And yet both are chronic corrections of a biological deficit. The distinction is mostly cultural framing, and I think that framing does real work. It shapes what people are willing to try, what they're willing to stay on, how they feel about themselves while taking it.
If someone's listening to this, and they're in a similar position, ADHD and depression, stable on both, wondering about tapering, what's the practical takeaway?
First, optimize the ADHD treatment. Make sure the stimulant dose, formulation, and timing are dialed in. That's the foundation. Second, don't taper during a stressful period. Wait for a window of stability. Third, find a clinician who understands hyperbolic tapering and is willing to go slow. Fourth, track symptoms with a validated scale, not just gut feeling. Fifth, have a clear agreement with yourself and your clinician that going back on the medication is not failure, it's information. And sixth, if you try the taper and it doesn't work, make peace with the combination. Being on two medications that let you live the life you want is a good outcome.
That sixth one feels like the hardest, the making peace part.
And it's not a clinical problem, it's an existential one. It's about who you understand yourself to be. If you believe your core self is the unmedicated self, then medication feels like a departure from authenticity. But there's another way to look at it. The core self is the self that can function, connect, create, and be present for the people you love. If medication enables that, then medication is bringing you closer to your core self, not further from it.
The true self is the one that shows up.
That's a pragmatic way to put it. And I think it's where a lot of people eventually land after years of treatment. The medication stops feeling like something external and starts feeling like just part of the picture. You don't think about your glasses as separate from who you are. You just put them on and see.
There's a line in the prompt about how he reached a pretty decent state. That phrase is doing a lot of work. It's modest, but it's also, that's the goal, not white-knuckling through every day.
Pretty decent is underrated. The pursuit of optimal can be the enemy of pretty decent. And in psychiatry, pretty decent, stable on a combination that works, side effects manageable, life moving forward, that's a win. That's a treatment success. The fact that it involves two daily medications doesn't diminish that.
If pretty decent is where you are, the question, could I be pretty decent on one medication instead of two, is worth asking. But it's not urgent. It's a curiosity, not a crisis.
And that's the headspace from which a taper should be attempted. Curiosity, not desperation. If you're desperately trying to get off a medication because you hate what it represents, that's probably not the right moment to taper. Deal with the identity piece first. Then, from a place of stability, ask the empirical question, do I still need this?
There's one more angle I want to hit. The prompt mentions that the whole journey started after gallbladder surgery, when self-medication with caffeine was no longer an option. That detail matters because it points to something about how people end up in psychiatric care. It's often not a clean decision. It's a crisis in an adjacent system that forces the issue.
The body rebels, and the mind finally gets attention. I saw this pattern repeatedly in practice. Someone manages their ADHD with elaborate behavioral scaffolding and a lot of caffeine for decades, and then something breaks. A health issue, a job loss, a relationship collapse, and the scaffolding collapses. That's when they show up in a psychiatrist's office, often in their 30s or 40s, exhausted and ashamed, having white-knuckled their way through life for years.
The diagnosis, when it comes, is both a relief and an identity crisis. This thing I've been fighting my whole life has a name. And also, this thing I've been fighting my whole life is a chronic condition that isn't going away.
That duality is hard to hold. And I think it's part of why the prompt's questions are so resonant. They're not just about pharmacology. They're about, who am I underneath these medications? If I took them away, what would remain? And is that person someone I'd recognize?
Those are fair questions. And the answer might be, the person underneath is the same person, just with less support. Not more authentic, just less equipped.
I think that's right. And I think the clinical literature, in its dry way, supports that. When you look at functional outcomes, employment, relationships, quality of life, people with ADHD and depression who stay on effective treatment do better than those who don't. Not because the medication changes who they are, but because it removes obstacles to who they already are.
To wrap the three questions into something actionable, yes, discontinuation happens, especially when the depression is clearly secondary and the ADHD is well treated. Yes, it happens under clinical supervision, but the quality of that supervision varies. Demand the slow taper. And yes, staying on both long-term is more common, and it's not a lesser outcome.
That's the summary. The only thing I'd add is that the person asking these questions is already doing the right thing, staying curious, staying in treatment, and not making impulsive decisions. The best psychiatric outcomes I've seen come from patients who engage with their treatment like this, as collaborators rather than passive recipients.
The pretty decent state shouldn't be taken for granted either. Getting there is hard work. Staying there is an achievement.
It really is. And if the price of that state is 2 pills a day, that's a bargain by almost any measure. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early medieval period, coastal communities in Guyana harvested a red seaweed called Gracilaria using a technique that took advantage of its optical properties. They would wade into the water at low tide during the hours when the sun was at a specific angle. Because the seaweed's cell walls contained phycobiproteins that made it fluoresce faintly red underwater, allowing harvesters to spot dense patches they would have otherwise missed.
Of course there is.
I'm going to pretend I already knew that word exists.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, who apparently spends his free time in medieval Guyanese tide pools. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. It helps more people find the show. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.